Bull grabbed her around the middle, and the two fell splashing and laughing to the water. Mum had laughed too. "I guess you'd better go rescue her," Mum had said, nodding toward the water. "It's you she wants." For a moment, a solitary pinch of time, she and Mum stood in the sand, looking out past the happy swimmers to the vast and endless Atlantic. "You'd better go rescue her."
"I will, Mum,"
Emmy whispered now as the sensation of the warm sand and hot sun began to fade away, replaced by the cold tiles. Emmy had no sooner murmured this promise than the sirens began their dreadful wailing, and she was forced to contemplate her options. If she ran outside to join those sprinting for the nearest public shelter, she would be noticed by the local ARP warden, whose job it was to account for the civilians in his or her sector. She could run for the nearest tube station, but those inside would wonder where she had come from, that she could suddenly materialize out of nowhere, and be in need of shelter in a space they'd been hunkering down in for weeks. As the first whistling bombs began to fall, followed by the thundering claps of their detonations, Emmy instinctively crawled under the sewing machine. Then an explosion rocked the world outside, and she knew she needed something to cushion her against shattering walls if it came to that. And Emmy knew where she could find that protection. She came out from underneath the sewing machine and stumbled into the dark store, yanking ebullient wedding gowns off their hangers as outside the air rocked with violence. She ran back into the alterations room, her arms overflowing with yards and yards of downy fabric. She scooted under the sewing table, then shoved the gauzy, generous gowns all around her until she felt she might suffocate. For the next 7 hours, until 4 o'clock in the morning, Emmy crouched under the singer as the Luftwaffe pummeled London, every word off her lips a promise to her mother. When at last an eerie quiet signaled that daylight was not far away, she nodded off, enveloped by bridal gowns. Emmy awoke mid-morning and emerged from her white cocoon. Her head ached from mourning the loss of Mum, and a heavy numbness clung to her, but she still sensed relief that the street and the shop had not taken a direct hit. The toilet still flushed. The hot plate still worked. She could make tea. She found a bottle of aspirin inside a cabinet in the privy and took two. With her teacup in hand, Emmy ventured out into the main room to steal a glance outside. As she was about to walk past the dressing room and Mrs. Crofton's consultation desk, Emmy saw a suitcase, standing as if at attention along the wall. A pair of gloves rested neatly on top, and a neck scarf was draped over one side. Mrs. Crofton was prepared to go away. Perhaps she would be coming by the shop today to get her suitcase and flee London. Perhaps Emmy could convince her to delay her departure for just a few days so that she could help Emmy find Julia. Emmy saw a neat pile of documents at the edge of the desk closest to the suitcase, and the unmistakable shape and color of a British passport. The other documents were folded. She picked up the little pile of documents and unfolded the first two. Mrs. Crofton's marriage license and her late husband's death certificate. The other three pieces of paper were her business license and her late daughter Isabel's birth and death certificates. Emmy noticed that Isabel would have been 18 on the coming Sunday had she lived. Such history bound up in such flimsy pieces of paper. Private pieces of paper. Emmy put them back where she had found them, as her burning cheeks reminded her they were not her documents. A stamped but unmailed envelope lay next to Mrs. Crofton's private papers, addressed to Mrs. Talmadge, the woman who cleaned the shop on Friday mornings. Emmy reasoned that she needed to read what was written inside, because she had to know what Mrs. Crofton's plans were. She needed to ascertain whether Mrs. Crofton would be able to be of any help. The letter had not been sealed. Emmy lifted the flap, drew out the single piece of stationery, and read what Mrs. Crofton had written. It was dated Sunday, September 8th. "Dear Mrs. Talmadge, I am closing the shop for a while, perhaps a long while. and leaving London to wait out the war with my cousin and his wife in Edinburgh. We are leaving Tuesday morning, so I shall not need... Emmy stopped reading. Today was Thursday. If Mrs. Crofton had left on Tuesday with Mr. Dabney, why had she not taken her suitcase and her important documents? Had Mr. Dabney not left yet? In her heart, Emmy rushed to believe this was the case, that Mr. Dabney had been detained because of complications from the bombings, and that if Emmy just waited there at the shop, Mrs. Crofton would be by shortly to fetch her suitcase and papers. Emmy could tell her what had happened. She could offer to wash by hand the gowns she had used for protection the previous night. Perhaps Mr. Dabney would allow her and Julia both to join them all in Edinburgh, once Emmy found her. Mr. Dabney could write to Charlotte and have her send the bride's box to him in Edinburgh. It could all still work out. Maybe it was possible that Mum would one day, indeed, look down on Emmy from heaven and see that she had rescued Julia and made something of herself. Perhaps in heaven, a mother was allowed to feel pride in a child's accomplishments after her death. Perhaps in heaven, you could see that your existence on earth hadn't been wasted. Emmy just needed to find Julia, and to have Mr. Dabney say he'd be fine with Emmy's coming later and bringing her sister. But even as she entertained these idyllic thoughts, doubt began to creep into her mind. Today was Thursday. Mrs. Crofton had written the note on Sunday. She wasn't going to be returning to the shop for her suitcase. She had either fled with her cousin to Edinburgh without it, or she'd gone back home Sunday to get some forgotten thing, and the Luftwaffe had found her. Emmy sank into a chair and dropped her pounding head into her hands. There was a way to find out whether Mrs. Crofton had made it safely out of London. All she had to do was step inside the nearest incident inquiry point and peruse its appalling list. But not today. Emmy could not look at that list today. She kneaded her forehead with her fingers, wondering how much more she could be expected to take. She had enough food for only a few more days. No ration book, no money. A place to call home for only as long as she could stay undetected. She had to find a way to search for Julia. But how could she without money? Without Mum? Mum. Emmy dug her fingertips into her temples. She couldn't think any more about having lost Mum. She couldn't start thinking about having lost Mrs. Crofton. Grief sapped her of mental clarity and made her feel weak. She could not be a companion to it now. All that mattered was finding Julia. Somehow she had to insert herself into the workings of the war effort, so that she could be privy to what became of lost or abandoned children. She needed to volunteer somewhere so that she was in the know, with the Women's Volunteer Service, perhaps. The women of the WVS were everywhere with their official badges, helping to ease suffering, administrating the evacuation of children to safety, serving food to the firemen, assisting the homeless and hurting. But how in the world was she going to pass herself off as an adult, who had every right to be on the streets of London on her own in wartime? Then out of the corner of her eye, she saw the little stack of papers. And Isabel Crofton's birth certificate. Chapter 24. Emmy's new life as 18-year-old Isabel Crofton began with a set of new routines. She sheltered during air raids under the sewing machine at the bridal shop, covered in a dozen wedding dresses. She found she much preferred taking her chances under a table, with easy access to the street, rather than huddled in a claustrophobic shelter below ground. A bona fide shelter was no guarantee one could survive a bomb. Mum hadn't. Emmy dared not be noticed coming and going from Primrose Bridal. The ARP warden for these city blocks was under the impression that the owner, Mrs. Crofton, had left London. If it came to pass that Emmy was noticed and questioned, she would just give the man her new name. She didn't think the warden would know that the real Isabel died 12 years ago. Mum had never volunteered much personal information to their warden. Surely the loss of a daughter all those years ago was a sad detail Mrs. Crofton had shared with very few people. Afternoons were spent volunteering with the WVS, specifically with finding relatives or foster families to take in the orphans of the city. Emmy projected a particularly impassioned heart for the fatherless and motherless, an ardor that all the other WVS ladies, in the relocation and evacuation scheme, seemed amazed by. Her tireless efforts to find and relocate the most innocent and youngest victims of the war to loving foster families often meant she stayed the night at the office, sleeping on a cot in case an ARP warden, during the wee hours, brought in a frightened child who hadn't been evacuated and now was suddenly bereft of his or her parents. She ate her one meal a day at the WVS canteen, sometimes hiding a roll or two in her pocket for later, as she hadn't summoned the courage to apply for a ration book under her stolen identity, and she had exhausted what was left of Mrs. Crofton's ration book. She visited the hospitals looking for orphans and scouted out parks and alleys and abandoned homes, looking for children who believed they were safer on their own. Emmy befriended the journalists and the foreign press, many of whom she could find drinking at the bar at the Savoy in the late afternoons or eating breakfast in the hotel dining room in the mornings. She told them to let her know if in their coverage of the war on London they came across children who seemed to be in the care of no one. After a few weeks of being Isabel, and spending every waking moment either crouched under the sewing table or looking for Julia, Emmy began to forget her old dreams, and in the forgetting, she found a numbing emptiness that she welcomed. The wedding dresses, that had at one time entranced her, were now wrinkled, smudged, and smelled of smoke and ash. And yet they protected her, cushioned her, were nearly a wall against the forces of evil. In the mornings, when she pushed the dresses aside, they still swished a greeting, but it no longer had anything to do with any dream of hers, other than to find Julia. Halfway through the month, there was a turning point in the battle for London. Despite its relentless nightly attacks, the Luftwaffe was unable to flatten the British defences and take London as Paris had been taken. The air raids continued past the middle of September, but they weren't as harsh, or at least that was how it seemed to Emmy. Near the end of September, she finally went to an IIP and looked at the casualty list. She found Eloise Crofton's name on an older listing. Her employer had died, as Emmy had already guessed, on the evening of Sunday, September 8th, before the Dabneys were to leave for Edinburgh, the same day as Mum. Her flat in Islington had been crushed by a bomb, and she with it. The Dabneys, Emmy noted, were absent from the lists of the dead. Emmy wondered only for a second whether Mrs. Crofton had been buried in Tower Hamlets along with Mum. But no, probably not. She had next of kin. Mr. Dabney surely came for her the next day, and saw her to Edinburgh just as planned, only on a different kind of train car. Emmy left the IIP heavy-hearted, and yet strangely grateful. In her death, Mrs. Crofton had unknowingly given Emmy a way to stay in London and look for Julia, as well as a new name and a new home, such as it was. A new life. Emmy didn't know when someone would come by Primrose Bridal to empty it of its contents, but it was hard to imagine that it would happen while the war raged. By October, the weather turned cold and damp. Emmy finally opened Mrs. Crofton's suitcase. Until that point, she had revered it as the last vestige of the woman's presence on Earth. Hoping there was a winter coat inside, since Emmy had left her own flat without even thinking about autumn's being on its way, she found a blue wool coat, as well as woolen stockings, several knitted sweaters, and flannel pajamas. Everything was a little big on Emmy, but she would not complain. She would be able to stay warm at night and outside. Again, Mrs. Crofton had gifted Emmy with what she needed to survive. Emmy started visiting the Savoy on Monday mornings to talk to members of the foreign press as they prepared for the week ahead to remind them to be on the lookout for orphaned children, and to pump them for information about any street children they might have seen but neglected to ring her about. She was often greeted warmly with a polite nod, but more often it was a cocky, "Here comes Isabel the Crusader!" Emmy didn't care what the reporters thought of her. She didn't care if they found that her passion for war orphans bordered on fanaticism. All that mattered was that one of them might possibly come upon Julia. On one of those mornings, near the end of the month, she was going about her usual stroll through the lobby and dining room, when an American seated at a table with other journalists asked if she'd like to have a cup of coffee while she tutored them all on how to recognize street children. Emmy had not noticed this man on any previous visit to the Savoy, and she wasn't sure whether he was taking her seriously or mocking her. "Are you new here?" she asked. "Not exactly," he answered, smiling broadly. "The place where I've been staying the last few months doesn't exactly exist anymore, so the Savoy is home now."
"And do you think the plight of orphan children living on the streets is amusing?"
Emmy replied, one eyebrow arched.
"Watch out, Mac," one of the other reporters said. "Miss Crofton will have you looking for lost little ones in your sleep."
The American, ginger-haired and handsome, gazed at her, wide-eyed, and his smile was even wider.
"I definitely don't think it's funny, Miss, Crofton."
"Then why are you smiling at me?"
The other men at the table laughed.
"I wasn't aware that I was smiling at you, Miss Crofton."
More laughter.
"Yank's got plenty to smile about,"
one of the other reporters said, a British man who was grinning broadly.
"They think this isn't their war." "Hey, I'm here, aren't I?"
the American said.
"You and your little radio aren't going to help us win the war from underground, mate. That's where you're wrong, mate.
Every time we broadcast from here, your American friends across the pond are listening with bated breath. My little radio is already helping you win the war. You just don't know it yet." The British reporter laughed and stood, as did the others around the table.
"You may as well take him up in the offer, Miss Crofton," the British reporter said, offering Emmy his chair. "The Americans still have good coffee to put into their cups."
"Yes. Please join me," the ginger-haired man said, feigning a serious expression. Emmy stared at him as the other men walked away, talking to one another.
"You are making fun of me," she said when they were gone.
He shook his head as he motioned for a waiter to bring another cup.
"Not at all. Want to have a seat?"
Her face was expressionless.
"What I want is to be taken seriously."
A waiter brought a cup of coffee to the table, unsure whom to give it to.
"It's for Miss Crofton,"
the American said, nodding toward the empty chair where the British reporter had been sitting. The waiter smiled and set the cup down.
"Please?"
the American said, cracking a tiny grin. Emmy sat down in the chair. The coffee smelled dark and rich, and a half-eaten apple tart in front of the American was practically calling her name. He pushed the plate toward her.
"Would you like the rest? Not as good as my mother's, but passable,"
he said, his smile growing. Emmy hesitated only a second before picking up the fork that was already on the plate and plunging it into the sweet confection. The first bite was nothing short of heaven.
"I can't believe I'm doing this,"
she murmured as she chewed a second bite, and then realized that any respectable adult probably wouldn't. She put down the fork.
"You may as well finish it, Miss Crofton. I've had all I can eat. Be ashamed to waste it."
Emmy retrieved the fork after a moment's pause.
"It would be criminal. I can't believe the cooks at this hotel can get their hands on sugar and cream when the rest of the country is trying to pretend that carrots are candy."
The American laughed, and the sound of it caused Emmy to raise her head and stare at him. It had been a long time, or at least it had seemed so, since she had heard laughter.
Sorry, he said. I like to smile and I like to laugh. I mean no disrespect, honestly. I know the rationing hasn't been easy.
Emmy slid another bite into her mouth. The rationing isn't the worst of it.
When she swallowed, he put his hand out toward her. Mac McFarland. My real name's Jonah, but everyone calls me Mac.
Emmy slowly reached her right hand toward his and shook it.
Aren't you going to tell me your first name? He said, smiling broadly.
It's Isabel.
Isabel. Nice to meet you. May I call you Isabel?
She brought the coffee cup to her lips and shrugged as she sipped, feeling warm to her core.
You can call me whatever you like, if you promise to let me know if you see any homeless children when you're out and about gathering news.
Emmy set the cup down, pulled a WVS card out of her skirt pocket, and handed it to him.
Women's Voluntary Service,
Mac said as he read the card.
Just ring me there if you see any when you're covering the news. Little girls especially.
Mac pocketed the card and took a swallow from his own coffee cup.
Well, I am happy to obey, but I'm not out in the street as much as the other reporters here at the Savoy. I'm a sound engineer, and I spend most of my time three flights down in a bunker.
A what?
Mac went on to explain that he worked at nearby broadcasting house for CBS, Edward Murrow, and a clutch of other radio journalists, tasked with keeping the people of the United States informed about a war that was now just one ocean away from them. He also told her he was 26, hail from Minneapolis, and that he had actively sought a London posting after Britain declared war in Germany. He told her being there helped him feel like he was a very small part of holding back the Nazis, since America had yet to join in the battle against Hitler. He had worked at a CBS radio station in Manhattan before requesting to be posted in London, when he learned a reporter friend of his from college would soon be in London himself.
I see, Emmy said. Finding that she was sad, Mac would likely be of little help to her. She hadn't had anyone to talk to about something other than the war in weeks. Something about him was calming and inviting.
What about you? Mac said.
What?
Mac smiled. I said, what about you?
What were you doing before the war?
I didn't exist before the war. Emmy thought as she pondered a suitable answer.
Unless you don't want to tell me, he continued.
But she found she did want to tell him. She wanted to exist in someone's eyes. She wanted to be more than just a spectral vapor who lacked an endlessly long string of yesterdays. Pretending to be Isabel Crofton meant she was entitled to a past. It was her right and her privilege now to come up with one.
My mother and I owned a shop, Primrose Bridal, near St. Paul's. She was killed the weekend the Blitz began, and our flat was destroyed. I am living at the shop for the time being.
Oh, I'm so very sorry.
And your father?
Emmy set the fork down in the plate, the ruse now feeling all too real.
He died some years back.
Isabel, I'm so very sorry for your loss, truly. I can't imagine how hard this must be. And here you are caring for the needs of homeless children, when your own sorrow must be so great.
Emmy smiled wanly.
I know what it's like to have your parents taken from you, and your home destroyed. I know what it's like to feel lost and alone. It's terrible.
He asked her about her work with the WVS, and what were her favorite things to do before the war. As they talked, Emmy sensed that Mac seemed interested in her, attracted to her. An unnerving and stimulating concept. Emmy had never had a boyfriend before, and had been kissed only once, the spring before at a school dance. It had been a sloppy affair that she hadn't looked forward to repeating anytime soon. Emmy could tell Mac thought she was pretty, also a new and intriguing concept. With Mum's clothes on,
and her comb nestled in her hair, it occurred to Emmy that she might actually look like her mother. Mum had always drawn the stares of men, even in her maid's uniform. Emmy liked that Mac thought she was pretty. She considered for only a moment that he was actually 11 years older than she, not the 8 that he believed she was when she told him her age. But why should that matter? She was Isabel. She was 18. When she left the Savoy a few minutes later, she could feel Mac's gaze on her. By the end of October, Mac was hanging about the Savoy dining room on Monday mornings, making sure he didn't miss Emmy's visit. He would save a Danish or sweet roll from his breakfast, and would invariably ask her to sit and enjoy it. Emmy, in turn, started looking forward to those borrowed moments of pleasure. That anticipation caught her by surprise, and she suspected it was dangerous to feel that way about their visits, which was something Mac picked up on from the get-go and apparently found alluring. On the morning of October 28th, Emmy arrived at the Savoy feeling particularly defeated. Julia had been missing for nearly 2 months, and Emmy was no closer to finding her than she had been the day she disappeared. Mac poured her a cup of coffee and asked her to sit and tell him what was wrong. His compassion was attractive. In fact, everything about him was striking that morning. This double on his chin, the timbre of his voice, the muscles in his arms as he handed Emmy a Danish. She didn't want to admit she was drawn to him. She wanted to believe that only Julia mattered. But that morning, Emmy could sense how weak she was. Resolve, her constant companion for the last 2 months, had apparently been left behind with the wedding dresses she had slept on. She was alone with a handsome man who reached out and squeezed her hand. "Is everything all right?" he said. The pretense that she had been carefully constructing threatened to crumble. She felt her old self clawing its way to the surface. Emmy made her hand a fist under Mac's, as if to smash back down the girl she had been before. "Isabel?" Emmy shook her head to keep the ghostly remains of her former life from settling back into the folds of her mind. "No," she said, to herself, not to Mac. But he thought Emmy was answering his question. "What has happened?" he said, stroking Emmy's bald fist, forcing her to relax her fingers. No, she could not go back. There was no going back. There was only the task at hand. She was Isabel.
I'm just missing my mum, I guess,"
Emmy whispered. It was as good an answer as any. Mac lifted her palm off the table and enclosed it in his.
"I'm so sorry about that."
Emmy was mesmerized by the warmth and strength in his tender grip. She hadn't been touched by anyone in weeks. Not since Mum put her hand in her cheek on the night she died. Emmy wanted to be in Mac's arms. She wanted Mac to pull her to his chest and kiss her forehead and tell her everything was going to be all right. She wanted to be enfolded in his embrace, and to disappear in it, for good. A tiny exhale escaped her, as she vented the tremendous pull of that desire to be held and loved. "What can I do for you?" Mac said as he squeezed her hand. Emmy summoned Isabel from the foggy place to which she had wafted away. She shook her head. "Nothing. There must be something I can do." As Emmy felt Mac's hand strong and protective over hers, and as she saw in his eyes a longing to be close that she didn't need to be 18 to recognize, she decided to trust him, to let him in, only halfway, so that she could have what she wanted, his help, and he could have what he wanted, a closer relationship with her.
"Maybe there is something," Emmy said.
"Yes?" Emmy leaned forward, imploring him.
"I'm looking for a young girl. Her name is Julia Downtree, and she's 7. She disappeared on the first night of the Blitz. She was left home alone by accident, and her street was bombed,
None of the neighbors have seen her. She's not on any of the casualty lists. The police have not seen her. She's not in any hospital. She's just... gone.
Is she someone you know personally?
Mac said, obviously puzzled by Emmy's interest in one particular child. Emmy had a split second to decide how she would answer. She knew he would double his efforts to help her if she told him the truth. Emmy didn't have to tell him everything, but she could tell him this.
She's my half-sister, and I'm the one who left her alone. I didn't think she'd be alone for very long. It just happened that way.
I was on my way to her when the first bombs fell. With his other hand, Mac reached into his shirt pocket, withdrew a slim notepad, and placed it on the table.
Julia, you said?
He pulled his other hand off hers, and withdrew a pencil from the same pocket. He began to write.
Downtree,
Emmy replied. Mac glanced up at Emmy, wondering, she supposed, whether she was going to explain how she came to have a half-sister.
We've the same father, and that's all I'm going to say about that.
The less Emmy entwined her two lives with explanations, the better. Besides, a gentleman didn't need to know any of the supposed sordid details. She said nothing else, and Mac quickly lowered his gaze back to his notepad.
She's only 7, Emmy continued. Blonde hair. The flat where she lived with her mother was off Queen Victoria in Whitechapel.
And where is her mother, if I may ask?
She unfortunately died on the second night of the bombings,
Emmy said, her voice breaking a bit. Mac again looked up at Emmy, surprised at her reaction to the death of her half-sister's mother. Emmy was fine with Mac thinking whatever he wanted. She did not try to mask the emotions etched across her face.
I'm so very sorry, Isabel. Damn this war. Damn the Nazis to hell.
He shook his head like people did when they were disgusted, and he slipped the notebook and pencil back inside his pocket.
I just want to find her, Mac. I'm all she has. I've checked with the police, and the hospitals, and the IIPs. They have no record of her being found. None of the remaining neighbors have seen her.
And you've thoroughly checked the flat?
Yes. I've been back several times. There is no gas, or water, or electricity.
No other relatives or friends of the family could have come for her.
For the first time it occurred to Emmy that Charlotte might have come back for Julia. Maybe that was why every search she had made on her own came up empty. Maybe Julia had been discovered by an ARP warden who managed to get her back to the foster home, where she should have been all along. But she had scoured as many evacuation and billeting records as she could since the night she and Julia returned to London. There was no record of a Julia Downtree being re-evacuated to her foster home in Gloucestershire. What she hadn't checked was whether a certain Charlotte Havelock had reported her evacuees as having run away. Surely Charlotte had notified someone when she awoke the morning of September 7th and saw that Emmy and Julia were gone. There would be a paper trail for that. There.
Isabel? Emmy snapped back to the present moment.
What?
No one else?
No.
But her mind was far away. She had to find out whether Julia was safe and sound with Charlotte.
Surely that was where she was. That was why she couldn't find any trace of her in London. Why hadn't she thought of this before?
Just because she had found no record of Julia being reunited with Charlotte at the beginning of her search didn't mean that record didn't exist now. Emmy rose from her chair and nearly knocked it over.
I need to get back.
Mac's eyes widened in surprise.
Just like that. You haven't even eaten your Danish.
I forgot to take care of something important. I need to go. Mac rose too, unconvinced.
Did you remember something about your sister?
Yes. I need to go. Emmy made for the lobby doors, and she could sense Mac was right behind her. He sprang ahead of her so that he could open the door before the bellman did.
Can I see you later today? A drink after work, perhaps? He said. I don't know. Emmy couldn't think about anything but her new task at hand. You don't know? Max smiled and held the door open wide. They emerged onto the street. A light drizzle was falling, but the air still stank of fire, ash, and ruin. Emmy turned to Mac to say goodbye. Thank you, she blurted, and stepped away from him. For what? Mac called after her. For the Danish, she said. You didn't even eat it. But Emmy just smiled stupidly and dashed away into the rain. Chapter 25. After so many weeks of frustration, the prospect of knowing that Julia had been rescued from the nightmare in which Emmy had left her was almost too much to take in. She nearly sprinted back to the local WVS office to revisit her inquiry into the evacuees who had been billeted with Charlotte Havelock. Emmy did not have direct access to all the billeting records for the children of the East End, but she knew where to go and whom to ask. Isabel Crofton's reputation for fervently making sure every orphan with whom she came into contact was properly cared for had been made obvious to all. So it surely came as no surprise when Emmy appeared, breathless and rain-soaked, at the offices where the East End billeting records were kept, and announced she had a lead on an orphaned evacuee who might have been reported missing by her foster mother. The WVS volunteer who was assisting the billeting officials offered to help Emmy, and together they pored over a pile of ledgers and files to see whether a Charlotte Havelock had reported weeks ago, on September 7th, that the two evacuees in her care had run away. After half an hour of careful searching, Emmy finally found a notation that Charlotte had called Mrs. Howell, the billeting official in Morton and Marsh, who had notified the billeting headquarters in London that Emmeline and Julia Downtree had run away, supposedly back to their mother's flat in London. Emmy and her companion continued to peruse the paperwork from September 8th onward. There was no new record of the Downtree evacuees having been returned to Mrs. Havelock. Are you sure that documentation wouldn't be someplace else? Emmy asked, a knot of dread rising in her throat. I don't see why, the WVS volunteer replied. Maybe you should ring up Mrs. Howell and Morton and make sure. Make sure of what? Make sure the sisters didn't return on their own, and that no one recorded it. Emmy replied, a little too forcefully. I mean, perhaps the children returned on their own. I would just like to know for sure. I've a report that the younger Downtree sister has been seen on the streets in Whitechapel. I just want to know if that is possible. She's quite young. The woman shrugged. I suppose. She picked up the telephone and asked for the Morton Exchange while Emmy waited, trying very hard not to pace. Yes, this is Vera Brindle at HQ, the woman said a few moments later. I'm just checking to see if the two Downtree sisters, reported as runaways in September, have turned up. They have been billeted at the home of Charlotte Havelock, in Stow-in-the-Wold. There was an interminable moment of silence, as the woman listened to an answer that Emmy couldn't hear. She wanted badly to yank the receiver from the woman's hand and shove it next to her own ear instead. Oh, I see. Yes, quite right, the woman said. Emmy closed her eyes for a second to keep from pouncing on the woman. Yes, no doubt. For the love of God. All right, then. Thank you very much. The woman hung up and looked at Emmy. No sign of them, I'm afraid. Emmy couldn't breathe. Truly? She finally eked out. The woman closed the ledger they had been looking at, as if that little matter was done for the day. Maybe forever. Mrs. Havelock has been instructed to inform Mrs. Howell if the girls turn up, but they haven't, and their mother was killed, you know, so it's a very sad business. No one knows what became of those girls. Hope that had filled Emmy's heart only moments ago was suddenly sucked away. A cold and iron-like dread filled the emptiness. The woman patted Emmy's hand. You did all you could.
Emmy felt as though she might vomit, and she raised a hand to her mouth.
Really now, you shouldn't take it so to heart, Isabel. You'll go mad if you do.
Yes, Emmy whispered. I haven't eaten anything yet today, and I...
But Emmy's voice faded. The effort of pretending her nausea was just the result of having missed breakfast was too much for her.
Thank you for your help,
Emmy mumbled and moved away.
You should go to a canteen right now and have something to eat,
the woman called after her.
It's not smart to work so hard in an empty stomach.
Emmy nodded and continued out of the billeting office and back outside into the rain. She tipped her face up to the sodden clouds and waited for the icy downpour to cleanse her of her mistakes. But as people walked past her and stared, she knew she was just a girl standing in the pouring rain. Emmy did not return to her afternoon duties for the WVS. She made her way slowly back to Primrose, on foot, hardly caring if anyone saw her. She let herself in by the back door, and soaked to the bone, curled up on top of the wedding dresses that lay like mattress stuffing on the floor. Tears did not come. She was beyond the uselessness of tears. But sleep finally did. Emmy awoke a few hours later, freezing, her skin chafed from her wet clothes. She changed into dry clothes, made a cup of tea, and hung the damp wedding dresses she'd been lying on, back on their tossed hangers to dry. Hours later, when the sirens began to scream, Emmy did not crawl under the sewing table. She sat in the middle of the floor, shivering from the cold, and implored the heavens to give her what she was due. But as incendiaries and bombs fell all over London, Emmy's frozen corner of the war remained stalwart and upright. When she fell asleep again, she did not awaken until she heard a tapping at the back door. Her first thought was that the bridal shop had been hit after all, and was on fire. Everything was hot, burning hot. Maybe she was in hell, and the tapping was the sound of the damned banging on the walls of their prison. She found she didn't care. And then someone said, "Isabel," and she wanted to say, "There is no Isabel," but her throat was coated in broken glass, and she could utter nothing. The flames were covering her head, bursting out of her chest. There was a loud noise, and then she felt snakes on her arms. They coiled themselves about her and lifted her off the floor. "I have her," one of the snakes said. A snake had appeared to Eve in the garden, hadn't it? The snake was the devil. And now he had her. She had gotten her wish after all. Emmy had been given what she deserved. She felt a blast of piercing needles against her skin, and then all was dark. Emmy didn't know when she realized she was not in hell after all. Her body still burned, but she was lying on a bed, not a lake of fire. A cool hand soothed her brow. She tried to open her eyes, but it was as if they had been melted shut. Not from the fires of hell, but from fever. Emmy slept. When at last Emmy opened her eyes, a dark figure stood beside her. The figure moved closer and took her hand. Was she lying on the wedding dresses? All seemed white around her. But no, she was on a bed. White sheets covered her. There were white sheets everywhere. She was in a room full of beds with other people lying on top of them. A nurse moved into her peripheral vision and bent over a man wrapped in white bandages. "Welcome back," the dark figure said. "Guess I came for a visit at just the right time." "Mac." Emmy lifted her gaze to look at him. "Where am I?" she murmured. "At Royal London Hospital, cozy and warm." Emmy knew this place. She'd been inside its doors many times over the last 2 months, looking for Julia. "I'm afraid I've blown your cover, Isabel," Mac said.
"What?"
A ripple of fear wriggled up from within her.
Recover? Did he know who she really was? Is that what he was saying?
I came to your bridal shop on Tuesday to convince you to come have dinner with me. The ARP on your street said no one was there, and I assured him someone was.
Dinner? Emmy couldn't think properly. What day is it?
It's Friday, actually.
Emmy couldn't remember what day she had last seen him. When had she run off into the rain? What had happened that day?
Monday. Emmy had seen him on Monday. And then she had run to the local billeting offices, where she had learned Julia was not at Charlotte's.
Julia was nowhere.
Your nurses tell me you'll live. They also say I'm your hero. He laughed and squeezed her hand. So maybe you'll forgive me then?
Forgive you? Emmy's head was spinning. You can't go back to your mother's shop, I'm afraid.
What? Actually, even if I hadn't blown your cover for you, you still couldn't go back.
It was too much to take in. Her place with the wedding dresses was her sanctuary, her secret haven. What did he mean she could not go back? Had someone figured out that she was posing as Eloise Crofton's daughter? Would she be arrested?
Emmy started to rise from the bed, but fell back against the pillows. Mac was hovering over her in an instant.
Isabel, you're very sick. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said anything yet. That was stupid of me.
Emmy felt instantly woozy from having tried to sit up.
Water?
She murmured. Mac reached for a glass at her bedside table. He slid next to her and raised her head off the pillow so that she could drink. He lowered Emmy gently to the pillow and then reset the glass down on the table.
What happened?
Emmy whispered. You mean after the warden and I found you?
There were bombs, Isabel.
Just a few hours later. I'm afraid the bridal shop was hit. All the shops in that street were.
Julia's book of fairy tales.
Isabel's birth certificate.
Her death certificate.
They were all inside Mum's travel bag.
I have to go back,
Emmy whispered.
Hold on, Isabel. It was hit by incendiaries. There's nothing left.
Mac didn't need to say more. She knew what had become of Julia's book. Mum's travel bag. Her clothes, her trinkets. And she knew that Isabel's death certificate had also been reduced to ashes. At least no one combing through the rubble would find it and realize she was an imposter.
Your bag is here, he said, although I'm afraid that's all I was able to grab the day I found you.
My bag. Here. He nodded toward a chair in the corner. Mum's travel bag sat there like an old, wise friend. It was still clasped shut.
Bring it to me.
Startled, Mac was slow to respond, but then he let go of her hand, walked over to the chair, and grasped Mum's bag by its worn handles. He brought it to Emmy, and she clutched it to her chest, embracing it as a child would cuddle a beloved toy. Tears of relief spilled out of her. Mac stared wide-eyed.
It was my mum's, Emmy said, hoping that was explanation enough. Thank you for thinking to take it.
He returned to the chair by the bed.
You're welcome.
For a few minutes there was silence between them, as Emmy held on to the last thing on earth that she owned.
Isabel, the hospital's a little short in beds, as you can imagine. The nurses want to know who'll be coming for you. He said gently. Is there a friend or relative here in London who can take you in?
Emmy shook her head, closing her eyes against the thought that she had nowhere to go.
What about any relatives elsewhere in England? Is there anyone I can ring for you? Anyone I can take you to?
Emmy started to shake her head again, and then an image of Thistle House, with its climbing roses and clucking chickens. Its shining pond, and gabled windows, and Charlotte with her long silver braid, filled her head.
Charlotte.
Would she take Emmy back? Or would she despise Emmy for what she had done? Emmy realized with a sickening thud in her heart that she no longer felt the urgency to stay in London and look for Julia. Her sister was lost to her. Emmy didn't deserve to be rewarded with finding her, and she knew now that she wouldn't be. The bride's box was at Bissell House, though. And although Emmy felt no tingling sensation of hope or aspiration at the thought of being reunited with her sketches, at least she would have them again.
"There is someone," Emmy said. "She's an aunt. She lives in Gloucestershire."
"I'd be happy to telephone her for you," Max said, then added, "or take you to her." He said this last bit as if he wanted to take Emmy to Charlotte's himself, but did not want to appear too forward. The last thing Emmy wanted was for Charlotte to learn over the phone what she had done, and then have to come to London to pull her out of the pit she had dug for herself.
"Would you take me there?"
Emmy asked. Max smiled. "I'd be happy to." Emmy nodded. Tears formed at the corners of her eyes, at the kindness of this man who thought he knew her. Mac leaned in, thumbing away the tear that had escaped and was now sliding down her cheek. He kissed her forehead. It was not the first kiss of lovers, yet it felt just like that to Emmy. A gnawing desire to be wanted, in every possible way, surged up within her. Despite all the mistakes she had made, she still wanted to be loved. Emmy reached up with one hand to touch Mac's face, and he leaned into her palm. "If London weren't a battleground, I'd be attempting to convince you to stay here with me," he whispered, kissing Emmy's wrist where it met his jaw. He rose from his chair. "I've got to get back. We've a broadcast in less than an hour. But I'll see you tomorrow, Isabel." Max smiled at Emmy from the door, then turned and left. As she listened to his footfalls on the corridor outside her room, she reasoned that it was okay for Mac to be attracted to her, and for her to be attracted to him, because she wasn't foolish, immature Emmy, who had abandoned her sister. She was Isabel, and Isabel had done nothing wrong. Chapter 26. Emmy didn't know how many hoops Mac had to jump through to borrow someone's car and drive her to Gloucestershire when she was released from the hospital 2 days later. When Emmy asked him how he managed it, and the cost of the petrol, he waved away her questions and told her he had a friend who owed him a favor. The handful of women with whom Emmy had served at the WVS, and who came to visit her at the hospital, seemed genuinely sad to hear that Emmy was leaving London, at least as sad as they could be to say goodbye to someone who had volunteered with him for only 2 months. The war made every relationship seem temporary. Someone else would surely show up to take her place. Mac offered to drive Emmy past the burned ruin of Primrose on their way out, but she declined. She wanted to remember it as it had been, when it was a lovely shop on a bustling street, back when the war was just a rumor, and even after the bombs fell, when it was a dark and shadowed haven for a young woman who had nowhere to go. For the last 8 weeks, Emmy had fought to stay in London so that she could find Julia. But on the day she left, she could not get away soon enough. As they drove out of the tattered city, gray from November clouds, and never-ending smoke and ash, Mac assured Emmy that he would stay on the lookout for her half-sister. He would continue to ask about her among his colleagues, covering the many sides of the war. He had the connections Emmy did not have, and none of the transgressions that she did. He was the perfect person to look for Julia. He also asked Emmy whether it would be all right if he stayed in contact with her after he returned to London. She could tell Mac was growing fond of her. Fond of Isabel the Crusader. Emmy did not hope for a minute that his affections would amount to anything lasting. He was an American stationed abroad. But she liked how he made her feel. She was taken with the notion that Mac preferred her over other women he knew, older, more experienced women.
Emmy would enjoy his attentions as long as she had them. She told him she would like that very much. The hospital had deemed Emmy well enough to be discharged, as they needed her bed for the wounded, but cautioned her that she still required bed rest for a week or two. She began to get sleepy as the car rumbled out of the city, and when she began to nod off around High Wycombe, Mac told her not to fight it. He had a map. He'd get her safely to Stowe. So she slept. An hour or so later, Mac shook her gently awake. They had arrived at Stowe, and he needed to know how to get to Thistle House from the village. Emmy told him which direction to head for, and soon they were traveling down Morgesbury Road, the same narrow lane on which she and Julia had started their escape in the dark 2 months before. It seemed like such a long time ago. And then, in no time at all, they were pulling up to Thistle House. Smoke swirled from the chimney in delicate tendrils, and soft lights glimmered in the front room windows.
"You can just let me off,"
Emmy said to Mac, unable to take her eyes from the cozy beauty of the house, its timeless perfection and stoic presence.
"What was that?"
Emmy turned to him.
"You can just let me off."
She needed to speak to Charlotte alone. Mac laughed lightly. "Not a chance." He put the car in park and set the brake.
"Please, Mac. My aunt and I, didn't part in the best of times. And I didn't ring her up to tell her I was coming."
He turned the car off.
"Well, then I'm definitely not just leaving you off. What if she says no, you can't stay?"
Emmy looked back at the house. She saw a face at the window. Charlotte's.
"She won't say no."
Mac reached for her hand and squeezed it.
"Then you've got nothing to worry about."
"Give me a second with her, please. Just wait here a bit, will you?" He frowned.
"Well, if you think that's necessary."
"I do," Emmy said hurriedly, withdrawing her hand from under his. "Just give me a moment so that I can tell her why I'm here. And what has happened. She probably doesn't know."
The red door opened, and Charlotte appeared, wiping her hands on a dish towel.
Emmy opened the car door, and the biting chill of the outside air prickled her.
"I'll be right back."
She stepped out of the car, purposely keeping her back to the house as she maneuvered out. She closed the door, kept her head down, and walked up the stone pathway to the front door. Emmy was wearing Mum's second-best dress, Eloise Crofton's blue wool coat, and a knitted hat Mac had bought for her to keep her head warm. From a distance, and with her gaze fixed on her heeled shoes, Emmy knew she did not look like the 15-and-a-half-year-old who had run away from this house just weeks before. When Emmy was only a few feet from the door, she raised her head to look at Charlotte, and their eyes met.
"Emmeline."
Emmy's name came out of Charlotte's mouth like a breath, like a prayer. She bolted forward and drew Emmy into her arms. Weak from illness, and so ready to be held by someone who cared for her, Emmy nearly collapsed into her tight embrace.
"Are you all right?"
Charlotte said, and Emmy smelled pie crust and cinnamon and nutmeg in the woman's gray braid. Before Emmy could answer, she pulled away and looked past Emmy to the waiting car. Emmy saw in Charlotte's shimmering irises what her eyes sought. Julia. A blade seemed to slice into Emmy's chest.
"It's just me, Charlotte," she whispered.
With her arms still on Emmy's shoulders, Charlotte looked hard into her eyes.
"Is Julia... has she..."
But Charlotte could not finish her question. Emmy shook her head.
"I don't know. I don't know where she is."
The familiar nausea at saying these words swept over Emmy and she faltered. Charlotte caught Emmy as spots began to dance in front of her.
"Emmeline, are you ill?"
She nodded. Charlotte's firm arms were around her again in an instant.
Who is that in the car?
A friend. The only friend I have, actually. He brought me here. His name is Mac. He's an American.